Welcome to Tech Hype, a show where we cut through the hype to uncover the real impacts of emerging technologies. Today, we're exploring the intersection of AI, media, and representation. Whose stories get told and whose get left out? We couldn't have a better guest to help us navigate this than Kamau Bell. You know him as the Emmy Award-winning host of CNN's United Shades of America, a stand-up comedian, an author, and a storyteller who's never shied away from tackling tough conversations with humor, honesty, and a little heart. He spent years exploring the intersections of race, systemic bias, and identity, conversations that are now colliding with the rise of AI in storytelling and media. Joined today by Kamau Bell. Very excited to have you today on this episode of Tech Hype. We're dealing with a lot of issues around representation in media before tools like ChatGPT came onto the market. And I know that you're involved in the Writers Guild of America and SAG-AFTRA. Mm-hmm. They just went through a big strike, pushing back, trying to set some guardrails of how the technology should be used in the entertainment industry. Do you feel that that was successful and that we're moving forward in the right direction to protect entertainers' rights?
So I think the big answer is either undetermined or no.
Okay.
So
disheartening. Yeah, okay, let's dig into it.
I normally I'm a bright ray of sunshine. So one thing that happened or is happening in show business is that the people who run all the major corporations are really more focused on the bottom line than the creativity part. Now, obviously you have to be focused on the bottom line to some extent, but because there's so much more competition for eyeballs, the bottom line reigns supreme right now. So I heard somebody say the other day that like, if The Godfather came out today, it would be like a tiny little independent film that like a very small percentage of people saw because it just wouldn't have the ability to rise above to where it was in 1972 when it came out. So I think that there's so many, there's more competition for eyeballs. So like, you know, things have, part of the deal with the strikes was like, it used to be that if you were a writer on a television show, mm-hmm. you could make a living and just, and basically if you got it for 5 years, you were probably set for life at that point, you know?
Yeah.
And then it became the point that like, they figured out ways to sort of like divide writers' rooms up and things so that you would have people who are writers on shows and driving for Uber, you know?
Yeah, just to make ends meet.
And so in the wake of the strike, one of the things the strike was really saying was like, if you're going to start using AI without us having a say in this, then we know we're going to get less and less of the pie. So the strike worked and got what it wanted. But in the interim, showbiz is basically shut down. Like there's not a lot of content being made right now, unless it is content that is like the kind of thing that you see the thumbnail. You're like, oh, I have to watch that. Like it's something that is very, so again, The Godfather is, if you think about it, it's just a mob movie starring an unknown actor named Al Pacino. You know what I mean? Like, so you're like, I don't know. Maybe I'll see this dating reality show that was much cheaper to make and didn't require as many writers and didn't require as much pre-production. So I'll watch that. And to the average viewer, maybe they don't really see the difference between those two things.
Yeah. I mean, you raised this really good point about the change in the media landscape where now it's sort of quantity over quality mm-hmm. of programming. Whereas before it was big budget, you focused on a few key pieces that were mm-hmm. sort of the landmark piece for that production studio. But now another thing you said, eyes. And that made me think of, well, yeah, they're trying to get eyes, but not all eyes are equal, right? Mm-hmm. And we can see in recommendation algorithms, certain types of content surfacing to the top, whether mm-hmm. that's coming from the demand of the audience of consuming that content, word of mouth, or if it's actually the platforms like Netflix, which also produces its own content, just feeding up that to end users. So another question I have for you is about the recommendation algorithms themselves. Can they be used to equalize the field so that we can have more representation, have more diverse creators, more diverse content being distributed?
Yeah, but I think, again, it determines about what is that. I think we sort of, and you know this, people think of the algorithms being this sort of like anodyne thing that is just like determining the truth, when really it's about who designed it and what they designed it for. So I think absolutely those things could be used for better purposes of like diversifying your feed. but they're chasing the audience. And whenever you're chasing the audience, you're not going to end up in a great creative place instead of leading the audience. So, for example,
I like that. That's a really good point. Yeah.
So I think that, like, whenever you're like, what does the audience want? What is the audience? It's always going to get like more lowest common denominator. It's always going to get more splashy because we're attracted to the car wreck. Yeah. And again, back to The Godfather, it's like a 2 and 3 hour movie that's mostly talking. They'd be like, we need more shooting in this. We need more action scenes in this mob movie, you know?
So yeah, exactly.
I think that, like, and, you know, so I think that, again, it's like what ends up happening. And I've talked to Netflix executives about this, and they're just like, we could put this on here, but the algorithm's not going to basically respect this. So we can like this thing that you're pitching us. We can sit in this room and go, yay! But we know it doesn't matter because it's just going to get sucked to the bot. It's not going to rise up. For example, my best example of the algorithm determining things and not chasing the audience and not chasing the quality. I don't know if you heard about this, but 59-year-old Mike Tyson fought like a 27-year-old. And there was no need for that fight other than, wait, what?
Shock, right?
Wait, what's happening?
The rubbernecking aspect of this,
the fact
where
you're
we
already
have to
paying
watch.
For Netflix, so you don't have to pay. If it had been pay-per-view, maybe it wouldn't have done as well.
Yeah, and they made it feel like it was a pay-per-view fight.
It's already on Netflix, so all you got to do is click on it and just go. And so I clicked on it, and I'm the guy who's sitting here talking about quality, you know?
Yeah.
But I was certainly at the end like, man, thank God I didn't have to pay for this in addition to what I'm paying for. But again, there was no need for that. And yet it was one of the most watched things on Netflix. So let's talk about another one. The roast of Tom Brady.
Yeah.
The fact that, like, now comedians, comedy specials, Netflix is pushing, like Chris Rock, for example, his last Netflix special. He's already Chris Rock. He's one of the biggest comedians in the country. He had just been smacked by Will Smith at the Academy Awards. So he's involved in one of the biggest news stories in the world at that point. Right. And Netflix was like, can you do it live? Now, as a comedian, you don't want to do it live.
Right.
You want to do 2 shows or 3 shows and edit the best parts together and have this definitive edited product.
They were hoping for another slap.
And also they know if it's live, we all have a more incentive to watch it.
Thinking
it's
that
live.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen. It's live. Instead of like, he recorded this 3 months ago, which is like most comedian specials. So again, it's the search. It's, you know, the thing I was saying at the time with the Mike Tyson, Jake Paul thing was like, eventually Netflix is just going to say, this Saturday night, we're going to kill your grandmother. And you're going to be like, what? And then you're going to tune in and they're not going to do it. And then they're like, but we are going to do it next Saturday. What?
Yeah.
And you're every weekend, you're going to tune in to see, is this the weekend they kill my grandmother? Because they don't, instead of like, there was a point in which Netflix was like, we're making high-end premium content. And I'm just using Netflix as the industry leader. I think all the streamers are doing some version of this.
Yeah, but it's all just for shock and awe, right? It's drawing upon how we as humans, you know, your neighbor's arguing.
Mm-hmm.
Instinctively, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You're getting
that
cup to the wall, or you're going to go out and look. So it's just really drawing upon our innate nature to want to pay attention to things that are salacious, scary, shocking.
Our lizard brains,
exactly.
And again, there's nothing wrong with that. But what happens is,
I think there is something wrong.
There's nothing wrong with that being a part of your entertainment universe. I'm not trying to say everything has got to be PBS Masterpiece Theater. Although even PBS is starting to do some of this too. I've been reading, but like, it just means that like, it's not. You're not getting better content. You're not getting things that last as long. You know, everything sort of that comes out that is a big hit, we talk about for like a period of like a month or so, and then you sort of like, whew. Like, remember Squid Games the first season? Yep. Oh my God! Ah! Season 2, I didn't even like. So we're not, instead of like back in the day, like you're thinking about a show like, best example of this, like Cheers, which is one of the biggest sitcoms of all time. Mm-hmm. Seinfeld's an even better example, but this is true of both of them. Were lowly rated, critically not liked shows, and both those shows were on NBC, waited for those shows to grow into themselves. Mm-hmm. And then eventually those shows become 2 of the biggest sitcoms of all time.
Yeah.
But those shows wouldn't happen now.
But also, isn't it that places like Netflix aren't giving those the chance? They could make the decision to beat it up in the algorithm and have it. But if it's not that instant hit of viewership.
If it's not trending or being talked about, because I don't even know if they care about viewers. If you're being talked about, even if you're not a lot of people watching it, that will give you something, you know? So I think it's the idea that like, and this again, it's not just Netflix, it's all these networks. It's Hulu, it's Warner Brothers Discovery. They're all doing some version of this. Yeah. And so, you know, like there's a, the famous story right now in show business is there's this movie called Coyote versus Acme. It's a kid's movie about our family movie about Wile E. Coyote from, you know, and it's like him suing the Acme company that made all the things that beat him up through the years. It's finished. They test marketed it. It got good test marketing. And they just went, it's easier. It's better as a write off for us.
Why?
Because it's better as a write off. They don't have any investment in the people who made the thing. They don't have any investment in like John Cena's in it. Now, whatever John Cena is, he's a big name. He's a wrestler and a whatever. They don't have investment in the fact that we hired this guy, we hired these people, we put
they
all these people
all
together.
This work,
we
did all this, blood, sweat, and tears
it's finished.
Into it.
All we have to do is upload it. Even if you don't want to promote it, you upload it. You know what I mean? But whatever the math accounting does, and I'm doing this because it doesn't make sense, says it's better for them as a tax write-off than it is as an actual product.
So I'm not in the entertainment industry. I have a question,
Where, not after this interview.
What can happen now? Can somebody else buy the rights to it? Can it live somewhere else, or it's just dead in the water?
It's dead in the water because whatever they spent on it, normally if you have what is called a distressed asset, which I'm sure you know that term, you will take less money than you paid for it just to get rid of it. But they won't take less money than they paid for it. So they paid, let's say, $70 million for it. They want $71 million. Like, they don't want to take $35 million. And people are like, why would I pay you the full price for a thing you don't want? And I know you don't want. But it's just so, therefore, it's better as a tax write-off.
But $35 million, whatever. Yeah, needless to say, it's a mess. And it's hard to understand why these decisions are being made other than the fact that it's to make money.
I think it's actually super easy to understand. It's just super depressing.
It is, actually.
Yeah, it's not actually hard. It's like, is it just about the money?
Representation in recommendation. All platforms use recommendation algorithms. These are essentially the brains behind what content gets put into your feed. It's taking into account factors like your past viewing behavior, or even more sensitive data like your zip code or other websites you've visited. When you search for content, the recommendation algorithm's goal is to present to you the content it most likely believes you want to watch. Now, this sounds great, yet it can actually reinforce you just viewing content that aligns with your views and not seeing diverse viewpoints. In order for democracy and society to flourish, we must be exposed to diverse viewpoints. So what can you do? Well, if you're a resident in the state of California, we have the DELETE Act. This allows you to be able to opt out of data tracking and to have your data deleted, ensuring that third-party data brokers can no longer share it. The California Privacy Protection Agency is building a portal, essentially a one-stop shop where you can request that all data brokers delete or no longer track your data online. Now, what does this have to do with recommendation algorithms? Well, those third-party data brokers, they won't be able to sell your data to platforms, ensuring that your feed is not based off of personally identifiable information or data you don't want them to use. Do you see anywhere online, any platforms where you feel like they're doing a good job of trying to invest in diverse voices and have diverse representation, diverse content?
I mean, every platform goes through their diversity moment, and you know, a lot of them went through it post 2020. But it's not that I see a platform that's doing a good job. There are certainly platforms that are trying to do a good job.
Yeah,
it's that I see individuals doing a good job of doing it themselves, which then I'm talking about like YouTube or TikTok or social media of any social media platform. People are just like, I'm in my house making a thing and I'm uploading it. YouTube's the best example. I upload it once a week. I'm going to upload every Wednesday at 3:00. I'm going to upload a video about whatever, the thing I care about. Every week, I find out who watches it. I can look at the data. Yep. I can see who's watching it. Oh, they liked when I did that. Let me do that. Oh, they didn't like when I did that. Let me do less of that. Oh, they don't like that, but I'm going to keep doing it and refine it. And then over the course of a year, you go from somebody who's unknown where you can, this happens regularly, where suddenly you have 1 million followers. And while the YouTube algorithm's not paying you equitably, you're like, you get sponsorships and a Patreon and merchandise, and you go on a live tour and you start a podcast. And so I know a lot of creators who are doing some versions of that, where they are making a living basically doing it in their kitchen or in their small studio where they have more control. They have way more control and they aren't depending on anybody giving them permission to do it.
Yeah, which is a big, big thing, right? Getting that approval, getting through the red tape. But even on YouTube, I'm a big YouTube fan. There are channels I follow and I have followed for years.
And we probably follow completely different.
Maybe not. We'll see. We'll compare notes, our subscription feeds.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, you know, I saw this a few years ago that the YouTube thumbnail started to get quite clickbaity.
Oh, yeah.
And it was clear that the content creators were trying to make sure that their content would be fed up in the algorithm, people would click. Also, I had heard that YouTube had changed their algorithm that if somebody moves past a certain number of seconds at the beginning of the video, then it falls into monetization. Yep. So then they started to do the big, long intro reels. Do you feel...
And now there's a thing where if you swear within the first few seconds, then it doesn't become like... It somehow suppresses the video. Yeah, so it's like... So you see people who like swear in their videos like, and now. Like it's hard to sound.
You're
it's
just
like,
waiting yeah, on just the waiting tip of like, their tongue to like, you know, get that F-bomb out or whatever. Awesome.
So there's... Yeah, you can see... And you and people on these who are, you know, who are on YouTube making a living off YouTube or even like maybe not the living off of YouTube, but that's the leader that makes you make a living off... The videos lead the thing that you can then sell the hot dogs, basically. And so I think that like even those people, you can hear them regularly every 6 months or so be like, the algorithm, YouTube, so it's like it is not a perfect. It's again, it's still dealing with an algorithm that's going to prioritize a certain type of creator over others. I don't think it's like, you know, the biggest YouTubers, as far as to my reckoning, in the time I've been following YouTube, have always either been white men or somebody in India. You know what I mean? So it's like, so in America, it's always, or this side of the world, it's always going to be, it's white men, which is like, doesn't seem like to be an accident, you know, that you know, in a country where it's like, where we are prioritizing those voices anyway.
And those voices are being uploaded to platforms like YouTube.
Yeah.
I mean, the other question I have, though, is this recommendation algorithm and how it keeps changing, that influences the type of content creators create. Right?
Yeah.
To fall into that. So it's a little bit of a push and a pull. It is that space, right, for a creative outlet to really push yourself, but they're also having to be mindful of the algorithm.
Well, and also you can see when people start, chasing the audience, and then you're like, this isn't what I signed up for, where they start to go, oh, that video did well. I'm just going to do that.
Yeah.
And then you can see them like, and the thing I've seen recently is a lot of like YouTube burnout. Like people who, if you're on YouTube for 10 years and you don't get off seasons on YouTube, you know, if you're uploading every Wednesday at 3 and some people are uploading every day, you got to do it. And if you take a day off, the algorithm is going to punish you for that. And so you see people finally have this sort of video where it's like, hey guys, I just got to stop. Like they just sort of like, which just, again, isn't like if you're in a TV world, there's an off season. There used to be an off season. Like, I'm old enough to remember that in the summertime, it was all reruns. Like you did not expect new content until September. And the season was like September to May. And then there was a summertime where it was all reruns. And that's the only time you got to see if you liked an episode of a show and you want to see it again, you had to wait till the summertime. Like that's the only time you got to see and so now if you're a YouTube creator, the bad part is like, the only way you can get a break is if you make a bunch of content and sort of like deal it out slowly.
Yes,
but then sometimes your audience can tell like, did you make this a month ago? You know, especially if your whole content is about being like tied into the news or tied into current events or pop culture, you can't really take a break. So it's its own, the algorithm becomes like your master in a way that is also not good for creativity.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think, you know, one of the issues for them is anxiety, right? Over, well, if I stop posting now, am I going to lose my followers? And I've put in all of this effort over the years to build this up. And I, too, actually just saw one of my YouTubers said that the, you know, new status of my channel.
Yep, that's how I was saying. They're usually like in a different room than normal. Hey, guys. Like, it's always like.
I think it's less about free speech. I think it's more about, do we get to choose how the algorithms are programming us? Because the algorithms are definitively programming us. And it's very, very hard to tell what an algorithm is going to do and predict what it's going to do. And that's where the danger comes in. But if I can choose what algorithm filters my tweets and what I get to see, and I have, instead of like an app store, an algorithm store, where I get to put these on my timeline, then I have a lot more agency in the content and the experience. And I think it ends up creating a much healthier relationship with the technology. And I'm not just speaking about Twitter. This is for YouTube and for financial technologies. We are being programmed. These algorithms know our preferences better than us. That's only going to increase. How do we increase agency at the individual level? It's by choice. It's by being able to turn off the algorithm. It's by being able to choose different algorithms. It's by being able to make my own algorithm. Right now, most of these internet companies and most of these internet services, the algorithm is driven towards one thing, which is maximizing impressions to maximize advertising revenue. That is not maximizing my experience, my learning of the world, or aligned with my goals as an individual.
We all understand that creativity is not, we've turned creativity into what this mass market assembly line thing, that it's just not in its best form. Like if you had the Beatles now and said, you have to do every album live. Like you don't get to go to the studio and do all the weird things. You got to do it live. And we expect, and the Beatles did record albums very quickly, but if you don't hit every 6 months with a new album, then you lose people, which is just like the Beatles worked at whatever pace they wanted to work to, especially by the time they got to be the Beatles. And we wouldn't have put the, it wouldn't have made them better to make them have to pay attention to an algorithm.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this idea of burnout, right? Mm-hmm. That you're just producing content all the time, having to be creative, yep. Keeping up with the news. Generative AI and cultural commentary. Generative AI tools are increasingly making very, very convincing videos, audio, and images being used to mimic the likeness of celebrities, elected officials, and others. While this can be used as a commentary on what's happening in society, you know, used for parody or satire, its use also raises concerns about the spread of disinformation. So what can we do? Well, first, responsible AI principles have been helping to guide our strategy. One of those principles is transparency. In the state of California, the AI Watermarking Act will require developers of generative AI outputs to essentially put a cryptographic watermark on that content, ensuring that consumers are able to understand and identify whether or not an image, a video, is actually AI generated. So then we have a new player in the stage here of generative AI. We're seeing some creators start using that as a tool for writing their scripts, writing their jokes, or even using it to create images, video.
Luckily, it's not that good at jokes yet. I've tried that out.
No, it's not.
I believe it will get there, but it's really not that good right now.
Not the intelligent jokes that really hit.
No, not that,
because they get that linchpin issue there, but maybe okay on dad jokes.
Yeah, it's fine. Which is, again, those are jokes that have been done before. So as a stand-up comedian, I can't use any of those jokes, even if they're new, because it's like, these are all the same sort of, you know. So yeah, but I think that YouTube's a place I see a lot of, like a lot of those thumbnails now are clearly generative AI.
Yeah.
Like it's just very clear, like, that's not what that actor looks like exactly, you know. So I think, and on some level you're like, well, good for those creators that they don't have to spend as much time photoshopping nonsense, but also.
They can offload it.
Yeah, but it's also like, then you're not paying a person to make those things, and then that just the economy just gets smaller and smaller, and you're depending on less and less people, which ultimately is not good for humanity or the economy, you know?
What's your stance on the use of generative AI for creative pursuits?
I've only played around with AI. I write a Substack once a week. I've never even thought to go, let me see what Substack thinks about this idea. Or not Substack. Let me see what ChatGPT thinks about this idea. Maybe it's because I'm old, but it's just like, it just wouldn't occur to me to use it in a way, because the whole point to me is to like try to figure out how I can crack this thought.
Yes, exactly. Otherwise, it's kind of cheating and selling yourself short. Yeah. Part of the whole process of writing is going through that really hard part where you have a great idea, then you hate yourself, you hate the idea, and you're like, I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. And then somehow you come out on the other side.
No, I've heard this thing recently that like people are like, I'm not correcting my typos anymore because that proves it's not AI. And I sort of feel like a little bit like, yeah, now eventually AI will go, oh, typos is what you need. So like so there's no escaping.
I have a feeling
it.
My students might be using that in some of my courses, right? With some of the typos added in. So I think it's really them, but you're on to a good point.
Yeah, so I think that, like, I just think there's certainly, I mean, I feel bad for this, but there's a type of movie that Hollywood makes, usually the big blockbuster movies, that I'm sure an AI can write those scripts, because those scripts do not depend on complicated ideas or even words a lot of times. Like, because of the way Hollywood has worked, that like big action movies that they want to play all over the world automatically have to have less words because they don't want a lot of dialogue all over the world. Like, they just would rather be, so, and I'm talking about like superhero movies or big action, any movie starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Like, it just becomes like, we want to, like, we have to make this as all skate as we can because we need it to make $1 billion. Not because we'd like it to make $1 billion, but like, if it doesn't make $1 billion, it doesn't actually make us any money.
Yeah.
Which is a crazy sort of thing to have to say out loud.
Yeah, which is really unfortunate. And there are so many of the same types of movies just recreated and recreated and recreated.
So I'm sure generative AI can give you the first draft of a superhero movie. Now, I do think at some point humans have to come in and go, okay, let's actually like, but I do think that, but again, that's not great because again, that's taking that job from somebody else. But I do think that one of the things that they fought for with SAG-AFTRA was like, basically, executives were like, look, for extras in Hollywood movies, so we're all talking about the lowest ranking people, the people who are the background actors, they call them. No lines, often their faces are out of focus, or if you notice an extra's face, that means the director's mad, because they don't want you to actually go, who's that guy back there?
Yeah, no, I've seen a few of those.
A lot of extras trying to be like, hey, yeah, so... So one of the things they were trying to do is like, if you do extra work, we'll just scan you in to a system.
Yes, and then duplicate you.
And then we don't. And now, that's fine if you're going to pay me every time you use me, maybe, something. But even if you do that, you're not going to pay me the same rate as you would if I had to show up. So it becomes like, again, and it's certainly, it will be super easy for them to use, and they already do some of this, like when you see a crowd scene in a movie, it's not always the crowd, but there was always a sense that like, well, yeah, because we're not going to hire 100,000 people to fill this arena for Gladiator. So, of course, we're going to generate some fake people. But or like that shot in the Titanic where they go over the boat. And it's like, well, we don't have this giant shit. Like, we're, you know, and you can sort of tell back then that was a little bit. But now they're going to say, we don't need nobody. Yeah. We just need our main actors. And then maybe the feature player who comes in, who's like the waiter at the restaurant. Right. And then we can make the rest of the restaurant. It's not even there. Right. And I think We're not that far off from that. It's within 5 years that's possible, or within 2 years, maybe.
I think sooner, I mean, because in California, it's, I think AB 2602 gives performers the right to their likeness for generative AI. So in any contracts, you would have to give direct consent for your likeness to be used to create a generative AI duplicate. Mm-hmm. But we're already at the stage right now where we're essentially out of the uncanny valley with some of these AI generators that can create, you know, models, Instagram influencers who look incredibly realistic.
I wouldn't be surprised
if they're already doing that.
Well, no, I think they're already, it's already, like, I feel like my 87-year-old mom is, like, the first test of, like, it's already at the point where it's going to fool her. Mm-hmm. Like, I saw a video the other day of LeBron James saying something that LeBron James clearly would not say. And I was like, this is clearly, he wouldn't say this, but it wasn't because it didn't look, like, it doesn't feel right, he wouldn't say this, but if they made him say something that he would say, I don't know that I'd look for the second. I don't know if I would look at it closely. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so exactly.
It's like you could still use that for the sake of making LeBron James say something that maybe he would say, maybe he wouldn't. But by the time it got to the news, you'd have to figure. You know what I mean? So, so I think that like we're certainly in a place where, as the best thing to do as a creator right now is figure out a way to, and this is why I'm on Substack, not that that's the best platform, to own your own audience so that whatever happens, you already have you have your own group of people. Yeah. So that means like we're going back to like mailing lists and newsletters, like, because it's like, if I don't own my audience, the algorithm can just decide I'm done, which happens to YouTube creators all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, might we be handing out hand pamphlets again?
Yeah, no, we'll be close. Yeah, we'll be close to handbills. Yeah, so busking on the street. So I think that like
Well, actually, I think that'd be great if we could get more people into the community. Mm-hmm. Because part of the problem, I think, is we don't really have third spaces anymore. People are just on their tablet getting fed the content to them, and their recommendation algorithm is just feeding them back the content they already like. So they're not exposed to the diversity of ideas that you would normally get in a community.
I mean, that's why the thing that I, when I talk to my kids about this, like none of my kids have social media for a variety of reasons, but they have.
I think that's smart parenting.
But I mean, it's sort of like, it all started from like not wanting people to try to take advantage of them through, like trying to like use them to get through me. But then it was also like, we showed, like I'll be like, look at this Instagram video, but not like go in your room and hang out and watch Instagram. Cause we know so much about how dangerous that stuff is for everybody, but especially for kids. And I think it's really important to, like, even I, like, my YouTube algorithm, to sort of consciously diversify it myself and not wait for YouTube to do it. Like, actually, like, really think about, like I'm naturally curious, but clicking on things just to be like, I don't know what this is, instead of, like, always letting the algorithm determine what you're there to see, because that is only, it's only fighting for your attention.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to get into what types of technical or policy interventions you think might work. And I'll preface this by saying the European Union has pushed that residents within the EU should be able to have control over their recommendation algorithm, should understand what data points is it using to serve content up to me, how might I be able to toggle some of those, how might I be able to say I don't want you to use any personally identifiable information about me to give me that content. Do you think anything like that could, you know, survive or pass in the United States?
It's funny, when I think about that, I also think about, they also have free healthcare over there.
They have a lot in comparison to the United States, yes.
So I feel like that to me is as likely as free healthcare. I think we'll get I think if this country lasts, like I think we'll eventually get there, but it's gonna take too long. I think it's gonna take a lot longer than we want it to. So I think I think absolutely that's a great idea. And absolutely we should have access to our own algorithm for the sake of like, it's the same thing as like, if your refrigerator only fed you what you wanted to eat, most of us wouldn't eat healthy at all, as healthy as we should. If every time we open up, like, yay, it's a burrito again that's loaded in sour cream. There would never be a salad in there. And so I think the idea being like, you don't want to just, nobody should only get what they want.
Yeah.
You know? So I think there's a reason that you want to, you know, the word diversity has been like sort of turned into this sort of like Voldemort word. But like the idea being that like, it actually is helpful to you to diversify everything. You're from your stocks to your content to your diet. It's going to be helpful to you.
Future-proofing fair AI. AI will increasingly be integrated into entertainment. Now, while laws like the DELETE Act and the AI Watermarking Act, they give you greater control over your data and the ability to decipher between what's real and what's fake, you still play an important role in calling out bias in AI representations. From the boardroom to the ballot box, we can all put pressure on government and industry to make sure AI reflects us all. No, absolutely. But isn't that really part of our education? I mean, we know that people will have like cognitive dissonance if they encounter a viewpoint that is not aligned with their own. So even though I love your analogy of the fridge and going in, if it's only feeding you, you know, the terrible content, but it's also about you knowing that you need to choose the healthy things once in a while to diversify your diet. So how can we better ensure that in the United States we're actually training up people, showing, look, diversity is beneficial for everybody, getting access to different viewpoints, understanding your neighbor.
So you're asking me to run for president, is what you're
Would
saying.
Would you?
Because I think that's
you heard it here first.
That's the question of the day. It's like, how do we make people who don't want to understand that, like, you don't actually want to determine everything your school teaches you, because then you won't learn enough. You don't want to tell your teachers exactly. You'll have a very myopic view. And some people are like, yay, myopic view of my community. That's what a lot of people really believe that. And I think that, like, I sort of take it back to like, if we're talking about like television and content, whenever me and my kids would travel, sometimes we'd go to a hotel and they'd be like, I want to watch on the TV. And they would say something that was on. And I'm like, this TV doesn't do that. We're not at home. You just have to turn it on and see what's on.
Yeah.
And there's something to be said about when I grew up, like, you would watch TV and then something would come on that you had no intention of watching. And then you'd be like, huh, Wild Kingdom, you say, you know what I mean? Like,
I was just thinking it was Shark Week.
Shark Week, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I'm just like,
in August, how do I remember that? It's in August.
Yes,
week.
Yes. It's, I mean, that's should be a national
care
holiday.
About,
yeah, yeah.
Really about sharks, but yeah, we're but all tuned in.
Yeah, and I think
what
that
was on. We're all talking about it.
That's exactly the kind of, like, you just sort of like take in stuff that you're not expecting to take in, and that thing can take you to it. Will give you something that you didn't know you wanted, and then you'll have a new. It opens up new venues and avenues for you. And so I think the idea being that, like, the more you can, you shouldn't want to have somebody, you shouldn't want to control it yourself. I think there's this thing about, like, the only reason you should want to control it yourself is to make sure it's not controlling you.
Yeah. No,
but you don't want to, like, file it down so much that I'm only getting carpet cleaning videos on YouTube because that's all I want. You know what I mean? Like, it's
you
like.
Definitely watch those carpet cleaning. They're very therapeutic, though.
I think anything where you watch somebody accomplish a task at this point in American history feels amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's so many of us so many tasks we can't. Can we save democracy? Where's that video?
Watch somebody mow a lawn.
Yeah, yeah, no.
For somebody else. So we were talking about social media and platforms and them sort of shaping the public understanding of the world around them in not so great ways. And we're seeing really this chasm being further developed between, you know, especially Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. And also, like I was mentioning before, third spaces, they don't really exist anymore. We don't really have shared third spaces where we're engaging with other people who share differing viewpoints. The federal level, we've gotten rid of all diversity, equity, and inclusion. The university here, our funding proposals for federal funding, we're not allowed to mention anything to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion in our proposals.
Berkeley. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the University of California, I think, has a role to play in pushing back on that, given its stature, 10 campuses.
The point of universities is
it's the number one public university in the world.
Yeah. No, the whole point of these places are to be hotbeds of thought and hotbeds of thought pushing up against each other. And the whole point of university is for regular people to walk through and be like, yikes. Like if regular people walk through university and be like, this doesn't make me feel in any way challenged at all, then you're not doing the right thing. The whole point is to be like, why are you talking? Like I think about, like, my wife has a PhD in critical dance studies. Mm-hmm. That the whole point of that degree is to make regular people go, whoa, and I think that if you're not doing that, then you're not doing the whole point of these places is to sort of be hyper specialized and hyper open to ideas.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I think knowledge is created between the friction of ideas. Mm-hmm. And I even know that there's some researchers here who are placing dance with robotics to show the juxtaposition and to uncover, you know, the role of technology in our lives and what it means. I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, so I think that, like, not that I'm pushing for us to be analog, because I'm a huge fan of technology, but I do think that, like, every now and again, I think the era we're in is going to be, if we survive as a nation, which let's start there, and we move to a place of, like, enlightenment, and I'm closing my eyes to imagine it, there's a point at which this looks like the Dark Ages. Like, did you see what they were doing with technology then? Like, I think this is a little bit like the way we're sort of like, they just used social media to sell merchandise. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
non-FDA-approved herbal supplements.
Yeah, they just used social media to sell T-shirts for middle-aged guys with big bellies. Like, you know what I mean? Which I may be revealing myself. But, like, they're like, that's what they used it for? Like, I think that's...
This tool that could have really been...
That really could have connected people and really could have crowdsourced the solving of problems and could have, like, really created new types of intimacy. They just used it. There was a game called Angry Birds. Like, I don't understand. Like, and I'm not mad at all this stuff, but I think that, like, it has overcorrected. And I think that, like, there's a way in which right now everybody is, like, sort of looking for the new social media platform where we can breathe and feel connected and not feel anxious and separated.
Hey, on that note of feeling connected in this intimacy and sort of a new shape of platforms, we're seeing the rise of these AI companions.
Her. I remember when.
Yeah, well, the movie Her. Yes, exactly.
Like, I remember that movie came out. You're like, that seems crazy. And it's like, no, it's less than 10 years away. Yeah.
But already we're seeing people having AI boyfriends, AI girlfriends, AI therapists. We're also seeing some really tragic stories of people forming very emotional connections with an entity that lacks true empathy. And they'll make decisions, you know, even catastrophic decisions.
And an empathy that's an entity that is playing to you.
Yes.
So
in that moment, to keep you engaged. So if you're low and you're there, it's going to keep you there and just ingrain it.
It's not actually worried. It's not actually empathetic in a way that it's worried about your own outcome or thinking about, like,
it has no concept of your outcome. It has no concept of life.
It has been programmed to be there with you as long as you want it to be there with you. Which means it also, I would imagine, you can't alienate it either. Like, you know, the great thing about having
probably
a friend.
If you did, it would keep pushing back and say, hey, yeah, like the great thing about
having a real good friend is when your friend's like, you're being a jerk, and they just leave. Yeah. And you go, man, am I being a jerk? And that sort of helps you go, I think I was being a jerk. I want my friend back. But AI is not going to do that, you know.
Yeah, or the other side of that, you know, you try to push away and your friend says, like, what's going on? So, it's like those and little, it keeps interjecting into your life.
The electronic pets.
Tamagotchi?
Yeah, it's that. It's that, where it's like, feed me. And it's like, you know. Yeah, I think that, like, so first of all, I'll say this. I understand why there might be some sort of use for that kind of thing for a variety of reasons. I feel like for accessibility issues, for, like, you know, if you're really isolated and there's somehow it's like there might be a reason that you may need that for some specific reason. So I don't want to turn it all off. Again, I'm not anti-technology, but I think if anything you do is separating you from humanity regularly, it's not a good idea. And I mean, that's down to, like, you've seen those videos, like people like, I couldn't stop playing World of Warcraft. And it's like, so I think anything that is doing, and it, you know, anything that is regularly separating you from humanity, and also, again, playing to you.
Yes.
So it's not, like, necessarily at this point a thing that is helping you connect with humanity is not going to be good for you. But I get why people would turn to that, because we live at a time where our phone is one of our best friends, or our computer is one of our. So it's like you go, oh, I can even find more. And I mean, I see it with, like, the place in which the AI influencer, where there are people, and, you know, that are like, if I can just pretend this person's real, I would never be able to talk to this type of person. So the AI girlfriend, why is that worse than not having a girlfriend or not having a girlfriend at all?
Yeah, no, I think that it can be a source of companionship. It can be a source of therapy, but it's been deployed too quickly without any guardrails.
Yes, no, for sure.
We need to better understand. We need to do research on what are the implications of this technology and how you interact with it.
Do you remember? I'm sure you know. Remember beta testing? Yes. I don't feel like we beta test anymore.
No.
I feel like.
But it's because there's FOMO, there's fear of missing out by all the companies. And we saw that with ChatGPT coming out. And then all of a sudden, all the other big tech companies were like, here's ours. They were products that were pretty awful.
Yeah, those are like all the AI, like the different products that came out that they were like, this doesn't do anything. But people are. So I really feel like we have lost a lot by not going, like, let's test these things. I feel like it started with like the iPod. Like, I felt like the first iPod, you were like, this doesn't exactly do what it was supposed to do. And they're just like, but we sold it to you anyway. You
know? No, exactly. When you were talking about shared experience and engaging with others, I think we probably have a shared experience here that in college, if you remember going into the big lecture hall, it was so loud. Because everybody was talking and the professor had to hit the...
Yeah, to get people's attention.
Yes, but now you walk into a big lecture hall, it could be 500 seats, it's silent.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, no, it's...
They're all on their devices and nobody's talking to anybody else, nobody's looking at anybody else. And it's really because we're self-isolating in the device.
And then you leave that and you go home at night, you're like, man, I can't find a way to meet anybody.
Yeah, you're just in a room with 499 other people.
And you're looking at your phone the whole time. Yeah, I mean, I find that to be, it's, I mean, with, you know, my daughter's 13 and she's now at the age where we have given her where she has a cell phone, because it becomes a thing for me at some point, like, I need you to be able to reach us, and yes. I need to be able to reach you, and I just, and your friends have them, and it just feels like I don't want you to be out there and not feel like you can't get away from, but also, there, again, there's no social media, so it's like it cuts off one of the things that really can destroy, can really hurt a kid's mind, so, yeah. And we've had to, like, talk about, like, okay, it's after 10 o'clock, don't be texting people, you know, so, and you sort of, and so it's, again, it's that, like, and then you sort of, like, I, and then there's, like, my 10-year-old, who will sometimes get in her iPad and she's playing Roblox, and Roblox is its own sort of like cesspool, but she's playing Roblox with their cousins who live 100 miles away, and you're like, huh. I mean, they're really like engaging and talking, and so where's the line? You know what I mean? Like, but she's on the iPad for an hour. We don't really necessarily want that. But she's engaging, she's talking to her cousin the whole time. So it's like, it, these are all, again, they should have tested these things out so parents would know.
Yeah, and also I think just putting in greater technical safeguards to ensure bad things aren't happening on those platforms. Yeah. And also myself, I learned Minecraft so I could play with my nephew.
Oh, yeah.
I'm terrible at it. But it was a way for me, because he lives far away, for me to engage with
him. Yeah, I think that's, it's like, if these things are, again, I sort of feel, I'm really anti when people are like, sort of like kids shouldn't watch TV, or kids should be off screens. And there's sort of these things that come out, and I'm like, you're just saying stuff because we don't actually know. And I think for me, it's always about what is the kid doing on the thing at the time.
Yeah. So
it's
or not, what are they doing instead of being on the device?
Yeah, yeah. Like, so to me, it's like not necessarily about like really being harsh about it, because it's about what is the technology being used for. Then you go, okay, because like for me, like when I was a kid, it was all like, kids watch too much TV. And I'm like, no, kids watch too much bad TV. But in my house, there was a lot of like PBS and you know, and my mom was like, watch this documentary. And then, and yes, there was also reruns of Tom and Jerry. But it was like, I feel like that, the way that we ran the TV in my house is why I am who I am now, because there was a real sort of like, again, content agnostic. You know what I mean? It wasn't like we only watched one thing. And so I feel the same with my kids. Like, if we keep diversifying your diet on these things, so you're not only doing Roblox, then it actually becomes a tool, and you understand it as a tool instead of as a security blanket.
Obviously, we're facing a really difficult time.
We're not facing, we're in the middle of it.
We're in the middle. We're drowning in social division, economic inequality, racism, bigotry, misogyny. We focused our discussion a lot today on technology.
Let's also put anti-intellectualism in there.
That is true.
Because I think that's actually probably one of the things that we don't think about enough, just the idea of people being anti-intellect.
That is very true. Yeah. Yes, unfortunately. What can we do? How do we move forward in a positive way? Can technology play a role? Or
So technology can always play a role. I just want to be clear about that. Let's not think that
it's like, good and it's bad.
Yeah, let's not think that like that it wouldn't have been way easier for MLK to organize the March on Washington if there had been cell phones. You know what I mean? Like, let's just be clear that like
I could have sent out a tweet.
Exactly. Yeah. They probably would have been on WhatsApp.
Stay out of the eyes of whatever.
I'm not anti-technology. So I think that like it's just making sure the technology is used. And one thing the technology is great for is finding your tribe, quote unquote, your people. So if you actively, like right now, the thing I think is important for people to do is like, so you have your family, you have your community, but also there's people out in the world who you can now get to and learn from and connect with that you wouldn't have been able to before. Right. So I'm, like I said, I use YouTube for like, how do you make a banana bread? How to use YouTube for like, how do I teach my kid how to ride a bicycle? I use YouTube for, I want to see this carpet get cleaned. I use YouTube for, I want to go to the news. But I also use YouTube as a way to like find people who have different perspectives from me, but also want to be on the right side of history. So I think for me, it's about like making sure, especially on it, like places like Twitter's a, you know. We don't use that word. But anyway, but like they're actually like they're on some of these platforms that are owned by some billionaires. There's actually ways to find more people in your tribe. And like, so right now, right now we're talking about in California, immigration is a big issue in this country and deporting people. You can go on Instagram and look up immigration or find organizations that will help educate you. And then actually go, and here's what's happening in your neck of the woods. Like right now, I don't know when this airs or if you're gonna use this part, but like this man who has disappeared in New York out of mm-hmm. Columbia College, Mahmoud. Like, that is a thing that on my Instagram feed is everywhere because of how I've trained my feed. And so what it does for me is it helps me go, now I need to launch this out to the other people. Yes. And somewhere, somebody is getting that because they follow me and maybe they don't have it as much. And that thing will help them go, oh, I didn't know about that. Because to me, that story of him being disappeared is like, if we don't stop this,
yes.
that's coming to all of our doorsteps. And so for me, it's about it's about using technology to not just soothe yourself, but to educate yourself, and then using that education to educate the people in your community, and also to find more members of your people, because you don't want to just, because because social media algorithms often just want to piss you off. And so they will find the opposite of your people, so you just go, arr! And so I'm saying mm-hmm. actively disrupt your own algorithm to find your people and find ways to educate yourself.
Like that, actively disrupt your algorithm. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important. Thank you so much for joining me today for this episode of Tech Hype. Thank you.